My guest today is Rich Deguevea, a phenomenal wildlife photographer who specializes in African safaris and beyond Africa. I say that because he's also supremely adept and experienced in photographing far-flung places like Madagascar, which is technically Africa, but quite different, but also much more familiar places on the African continent, but still atypical safaris like viewing mountain gorillas of Uganda and Rwanda. The stuff we cover in this episode is so helpful and includes things like Rich's approach to storytelling in his photography, his favorite lenses for African safaris, and gorilla trekking, two very different endeavors, his Sony ambassadorship, and of course his impressive social media presence, which he greatly uses for conservation storytelling. We're lucky to have Rich here, and I'm excited to welcome him.
Rich, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Court. Thanks for having me today. I'm really excited to be on the show and chatting with you.
Rich, you have an extraordinary CV, for lack of a better word, resume of the places you guide, the things you get into, the photographs you have access to and really make for yourself. It's an incredible guiding career that you've assembled. And, I follow along closely. And of course, later in the podcast, we'll talk about how others can follow you a little bit more closely too. But one of the questions I have right off the bat is having to do with the unique style of an African safari, right? The vast majority of your quote unquote classic African safaris are vehicle based or vehicle supported, however you want to put it. And so my question is kind of twofold here. So you have obviously unique access to wildlife via vehicles when you're photographing in Africa. What have you learned over the years about how to best photograph from vehicles? And then the second part of that is, what of those experiences do you translate to your on the ground work to perhaps make it even better? And the reason I say all this, just as background, Rich guides everything from your classic mainland, East and Southern African safaris, but also some of the really cool outside the box stuff like gorilla tracking in Madagascar. And I'm sure we're going to hear and learn about other places too. But yeah, to boil it down, what have you learned? What are some tips? What are some things you've internalized about photographing from vehicles to make the most of it? And how do you take that and say, you know, what of those lessons might make my on the ground stuff even better? If that even exists, I'm kind of challenging you there to see if there is a bridge that maybe you've learned, or at least appreciate the ability to say pivot easily around an animal when you're on the ground on foot. But let's start off with your thoughts and ideas, what you've learned over the years of how to best shoot from vehicles.
So again, the vehicle-based safari stuff is really fascinating because of the habituation that's gone on over years and years in a lot of the places that we get to travel to. And based on where you get to go, national parks versus private reserves will change all of that aspect, because in private reserves, we get to go off-road, get a bit closer. The animals are accustomed to getting you closer. But understanding the animal's behavior and giving it a sense of space. So many guides and so many people are focused on trying to get as close as possible to that animal. And 99.9% of the time, that is not the best photo you're going to get, is being close. Because the closer you get to something, especially out of a vehicle, you have this downward angle where you're looking down on something and you lose the background bokeh, you lose the impact of trying to get somebody to eye level so that they feel more comfortable around those things. You know, there's so many aspects to it. So I love encouraging our local guides, because as a private guide, I'm on the back with the guests, is encouraging and creating a relationship with the local guide to say, okay, cool, we have long lenses, let's stay back. Let's give the animal a bit of time and space to feel comfortable with our presence, so it doesn't feel like we're just rushing in and creating this discomfort within the animal. So you start from further back and you start getting landscape photos, animal in situ, animal with the environment, and really creating an image, because anyone can get a portrait image inside a zoo. You just have to zoom in. But in a wild area, you want to show that animal in its space. That's what makes it so beautiful. It's what makes us able to go back to the same parks to see the same animals because they're in a different place, in a different setting, in different light each and every time. So that for one is one big thing. And understanding that it becomes vehicle based, we're always looking at how we're going to take the next step. Because if an animal's lying in one spot, that's not often what we're going to get the magical photo from. The magical photo comes from prediction, from understanding animal behavior, for being ready for that next moment and saying, okay, cool, it's come from that tree to that tree. The likelihood is it's going to go to that next one and mark territory there. So let's go wait there. Let's not get it while it's sleeping. Let's go wait in this spot. We've got these photos that give us a general idea of where we've been, but now we need to make a photograph. And in order to do that, you have to place yourself. And you go set yourself up in the next location, ready to take that shot, having the ability to have a few seconds to get your shutter speeds right, to get your aperture right, to understand what the background is going to be behind that animal. And sometimes we hit it and it comes up perfectly. 70% of the time we miss it because that's the nature of prediction. We don't know what the animal's going to do next. And then that translates a lot to when you're not in a vehicle and you have more ability to move around, say, something like a lemur or a gorilla, where we a little bit more controlled in how we move around. But I would take guests and say, okay, cool, let's go wait here because the silverback has moved here, so that more than likely the females are going to follow along this way. We'll get them into those positions and then taking the advantage of while you're on foot to get as low as possible so that you can shoot up and make a big gorilla look even bigger, or get into a position where you're shooting almost at eye level with a lemur that's in a tree rather than shooting from the bottom up and seeing just a butthole, which is not going to give you the greatest photo in the world.
Such sage advice, especially that last part. That's great. No, but you just shared like three or four awesome gems there. I kind of want to recapitulate a little bit of that. You started talking about the angle, right? You know, so a vehicle, that's the thing, is when you're in a vehicle, and it doesn't matter if you're in Africa or Yellowstone or the Arctic, anywhere, when you are out of necessity, need to be above the ground, just, you know, you and the audience start thinking about the angle when an animal is on the ground. And as you get closer, think back to, like, you know, 10th grade trigonometry, that angle gets more obtuse. It actually increases such that the view is photographing further and further down towards the animal. And like Rich said, you lose that beautiful background blur. You lose some of the essence of the photography that you're trying to get with a really cool landscape around the animal. So that's huge. You know, the idea of staying a little bit further away, using telephoto power to your advantage, and seeing what happens. And that's the next part. And I love this because it really speaks to what we try to do as, in some cases, sort of like wildlife experts and biologists first. And I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the way I look at myself is I'm kind of a biologist first and photographer second, even though they grew very parallel to one another. But knowing the wildlife behavior is such an awesome thing as a photo guide. And it's something that I think we have as a super big superpower there. And then, of course, you know, talking about this wildlife and landscape shot, right? I mean, you took the words out of my mouth. That's like exactly what I preach all day long, is that if you get that classic wildlife portrait and you can't tell where it's at, it could be in a zoo, it could be anywhere. So super, super good advice there. So the first thing you shared about, yeah, you know, we have a telephoto, we have the lens, let's stay a little bit further back. I want to talk about gear a little bit there. So what, you know, if we're talking about a good beefy telephoto that allows you to stay a little bit away, makes that angle a little more acute, that makes it seem as if perhaps you're at eye level, maybe literally eye level, but at least it makes it seem close to eye level to a lion, to a wild dog, to what have you. What, talk to me about some of the lenses that you think are primo for African wildlife safaris? I know this can be a very subjective, contentious issue, but I'm sure you have your own opinions. And let's hear, maybe if you don't have a tip-top favorite, you know, a list of your favorites.
So I love that, Corten, the idea of lens and equipment choice, especially lens choice, is such an integral part to capturing an image, especially if you do this over and over, because every time you change a lens, you change the perspective from which you're photographing. So your photographs completely change when you use a different lens. Depending on where we are will give us different things. If I'm, say, in the Sabi Sands, I could get away with a 300 mil lens, no problems, because you get so close to the animals. And it's quite dense in terms of its foliage and vegetation. So that limits us in getting far enough away. Where somewhere like the Serengeti, a 600 mil would work so much better because you've got these wide open plains that allow you to see further and drop that angle even more. But the way I like to see photography and the lens choice is based on destination and based on your capacity to utilize that. There are so many great products out there. I love my 400 2.8. And the reason why I bought a 400 2.8 is because I can put a 1.4 times converter on it when I go to the Serengeti. And I've then effectively got an almost 600 f4. Or when I'm in the Sabi Sands or in Botswana and I don't need that sort of length, I take that off and I've got huge amounts of light and great bokeh. But it's a huge lens. And on its own, it's weighing almost 4 pounds. So you need to be physically fit to be able to carry that. Without that ability to do that, it's all good to have the gear, but no idea. That's not going to get you anywhere. In that case, some of these bridge cameras are doing incredible work in terms of that. I love the Sony RX10 Mark IV, and I'm waiting desperately for the Mark V to come out, because I think it is such a powerful camera. It goes all the way to 600 f4. It's in a tiny body that anyone can handhold. And that effective distance and that beautiful f4 gives us a little bit of bokeh. It's got great image quality. So depending on where you are on that scale, it's always a good thing to think of. And if you're spending the money that some of these safaris cost, if you do have gear, say you're traveling with 100, 400, because that's the lens you've got, and you're spending 20, 30,000 on a trip, isn't it worth going out, if you have the capacity, to then rent a 600 F4 because you're going to the Serengeti? You don't have to go spend 10 grand on buying one. You can spend a grand or two on renting one for that time and ensuring that the people you're traveling with have the ability, the beanbags or the gimbal heads, for you to be able to control that and get the most out of a lens like that. You can still bring your 100, 400 should it not work, but you can at least buffer yourself and really extend yourself each time you go out. And then you go to the gorillas and you say, cool, I'm going to rent a 70 to 200 or a 135, 1.8, just as something completely different. You know, how can you push your creativity by taking these lenses on?
Love that. Awesome, awesome advice. And for those that didn't get a chance to write that down, the Sony RX10 Mark IV, I'm going to echo Rich's thoughts there. I've had numerous guests in Africa and Borneo and Alaska, you name it, bring this camera, and it is awesome. It's really impressive. You don't have to change lenses. It's a 24 to 600. I actually didn't know it was F4 at 600, which is stunning. That in itself makes me think, geez, maybe I should look further into this one. But it's really cool. It's really one of a kind. It's been on this Mark IV version, which Mark IV just means like the fourth iteration of it, for years now, which is anomalous for the camera world. So, I mean, I'm personally expecting the Mark V any day now. Rich may know more about that than I would. We'll kind of get to his Sony connections here maybe in a little bit. But yeah, super cool camera there. And then I love to hear you talk about the 400 2.8. It's funny. I rarely see that out in the field. I rarely see it on Instagram, I don't hear much about it. I oftentimes see the 500 F4, the 600 F4, the 300 2.8, but long time, that has been like my dream lens. I don't own it. But if I were to be in a safari type setting as much as Rich would, I would say it's a worthy investment, very worthy. So you love that, huh? 400 2.8. Yeah. Like, because you can instantly pop on a moderate teleconverter and basically get to 600. So that's super cool. I think a lot of people, when they do have, the point in their photo career or their travel career, and or the means to do it, it's oftentimes a choice between those big primes, right? The 300 2.8, the 400 2.8, the 500 F4, and the 600 F4. And so you're thinking the 400 2.8 is your choice. They're all relatively similar weights. The 300's notably less, but yeah, more or less big old bazookas, lots of telephoto power, super big apertures for awesome low light and bokeh. 400 2.8 is your choice. Yeah, Rich?
Yeah, I just like it because of those variances, because I can effectively, like I said, 1.4 teleconverter, 2x teleconverter, and then I'm at 800 f5.6. You've got all this movement. It's also that tiny bit lighter and tiny bit smaller than the 600. And that size difference, when I'm traveling and putting stuff in a bag, I can carry my 400 2.8 in my Peak Design travel bag and walk with it on the plane. And that makes all the difference too, to be able to carry it on and keep it with you. You don't want to have to carry the clunky bag that comes along with it. The only thing that comes with a prime, the challenge that comes with a prime, is understanding how much it's going to change your photography, because you cannot zoom.
Yeah.
So your creativity, when you have a 100 to 400, 200 to 600, doesn't matter the variable lens that you have, but being able to move back and forth makes a big difference. In this case, you actually have to move the vehicle back in order to get that space. Or you're that close that you're now shooting portraits or more artistic stuff to be able to work with that. And in order to balance that out, I always have two bodies. So I'll have a second body with a 70 to 200 in case I need to, I'm too close or I'm outside of the range of that lens, then I can change and be able to shoot something wider and still have the effective use of it. But that all comes in. And then we talk about the Sony again and bring back the bridge camera, even the Canons that have these same bridge features that have long lenses. When you want to, you can zoom out and get to a point that's far more advantageous to get and make a photograph, make something pretty.
Love it. Yeah, what a killer combo. 400 2.8 and then a 70 to 200 2.8. Well, you heard it from Rich. That is his go-to safari combo. I couldn't agree more. That is an awesome setup. Then you mentioned a 1.4 extender. I haven't spoken a lot about extenders on this podcast. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Yay, nay. Obviously, you're in support of them. Are they ubiquitous? Like, do you use them all the time? Are there certain cases? What are your thoughts?
So teleconverters are interesting. They've been a dividing factor for years, years and years and years. I think the first iterations of them were always an extra piece of glass that softened an image somewhat. And people were going, well, is it really worth putting it on? A lot of the times now, even that question comes in because we have these high megapixel cameras that, okay, if I'm not that close, I can just crop in and I'm still at 30 megapixels or 24 megapixels. But I found that the new generations of these teleconverters are incredibly sharp. There's almost zero loss in image quality across the way, especially with the mirrorless iterations of it. I think with the mirrored versions, when we were DSLR, there were definite cons to it. But now it makes sense. The only thing that really has to be thought of, and it works well on a 2.8, but it doesn't work well on 100 400 f5.6, because the moment you drop that on, you're not just getting closer, but you're shutting that aperture down. And light is such a key thing in wildlife photography. We're always trying to get as much light, as fast as shutter speed, to freeze the action, to be in control of that situation. And the moment you put that converter on, you are stifling that ability to get more light.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a balance. It's a complete balance. That's why I find with 400 2.8, it works beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
100 400, it doesn't even pack in my bag. I don't even bring it close because by the time I get there, I'm at F9 and I'm out of the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back in the day, when I used to shoot a lot with the 70 200 2.8, I thought, you know, this might be the best kind of wildlife combo. Get a 70-200 and a 2x converter, and that way I can get a 400 f5.6. I dropped that like a bad habit. It was so soft. Like it, I might as well just shoot with a 70-200 and crop in. It was so disappointing. But I love to hear what you say about the new mirrorless iterations. That gives me a lot of hope. And of course, for those in the audience, anytime you use a teleconverter or teleextender, tomato tomato, on a prime lens, you're in a way, way better shape. Zoom lenses just, they don't really behave very well with teleconverters. So I continue on this lens and gear thing. I remember seeing a photo from you, Rich. Oh, I see a lot of photos from you, but a particular one of a chimpanzee. I'm pretty sure it was in Kibale, Uganda. And I was looking at like your shot settings and I saw you were shooting with a 135 1.8 lens. And I'm like, what is this guy doing? He's using a wedding photographer lens on an epic chimp trek. Of course, the photo was stunning. Talk to me about that. Like 135, 1.8, is that a routine lens you bring with you just because of how unique it is? Or what's going on there?
So again, I'd mentioned it a bit earlier that every time you go out with a new lens, you're allowing a new perspective, a different way to view the world. And the thought was, well, I'm shooting our close cousins, and this is a portrait lens. So why can't they be a portrait? On top of the fact that it is so dark in the jungles that trying to shoot over 200th of a second, you're fighting. Mm-hmm. So having a 1.8 is incredibly advantageous. But shooting with that lens and its prime one, and I'd shot for years with the 70 to 200, so I had the same images over and over again. Each time, still the same gorilla or same chimpanzee with the same perspective. The moment I put a new lens on, it changed everything. So with my ambassadorship with Sony, I got to test different things out. So it was a case of I'm in the prime seats to be able to say, oh, I'd like to test that one out. Can I have that for a week while I go to the gorillas and chimps and have a shoot with that? And I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I haven't put it permanently in my bag because it's an expensive lens, but it's a nice one to toy around with. And I don't think it's the last time I'll go. My next one I actually want to fiddle around with is a 50mm f1.2. Mm. Again, very prime, very portrait-based, low light, shallow depth of field, good bokeh, and see what I get out of the gorillas and chimps with that. Again, slightly wider, create more jungle shots, but with the shallow depth of field and speed to be able to freeze the action. So it's always a consideration. How can I change what's going in front of my camera to change the perspective of what my viewer is going to see when they look at the photo on Instagram or on any form of media?
Heck yeah, I love it. And it was a stunning photo. We'll provide links to his Instagram where you can see that photo and many others. It was stunning. It was a portrait. And the cool thing is, you know, we were kind of dogging some of the wildlife portraits on the Serengeti and whatnot. When you're in that dense forest at Kibale, there is no mistaking you are in the legit jungle. I mean, there's vegetation and leaves everywhere. You can't mistake that. And that's also not to say, you know, wildlife portraits are fantastic wherever you go. We're really talking about thinking outside the box here, but that lens, super awesome. Love to hear it. Okay, so another big place, and then, you know, this will sort of be our last little foray on lenses and gear, but gorilla trekking. What's your go-to lens for gorilla trekking? What do you have on your camera as you know, drop your bags off with the trackers and you head into that last 100 yards, you're stepping over vines, you know, you got that anticipation, no matter if it's the 100th time you've done it, you've got a camera, a lens on, and maybe a lens in your pocket. What do you have?
So my go-to is a 70 to 200, 2.8. Mm-hmm. That variability of being able to go a little bit wider and have the portrait ability of the 200 and get a bit closer, without a doubt, that lens was, it was almost built to go shoot primates. But in that same setting, the lenses are so important, but how you strap them to you is so important too. And having a good strap to be able to put that camera around you and tuck it behind you, because you're in a forest environment, you're walking between things, like you're saying, you're stepping over vines. We're in windy, impenetrable forest. They didn't call it impenetrable for nothing. And I think the way you go in and the preparation that you have, not just with how you're going to shoot, but how you're going to carry, I very often would take a second body, or I will take one lens and one body and focus one trek just in one dimension. And then the second trek, I may then go, okay, cool, I'm going to take the 16 to 35 mil and shoot uber wide and wait for gorillas who may walk past me to get down low, shoot up, create a different atmosphere. Again, just changing the perspective and pushing myself. For a first time, at 70 to 200 straight away. If you're doing four treks, then I'd say, okay, one of them, be out there. Throw it all out there. Leave your 70 to 200 behind. Take a lens that's going to challenge you creatively and throw yourself in the in that pot and see where it comes out. But yeah, it's a very fascinating choice of stuff. Like I said, the 50 mil is now my next one I want to play with. The 135 I've used before. I've taken a 400 in there, which was very interesting, but a lot to carry. And the porters look at you funny when you bring them a bag that weighs 10 pounds to then carry.
Gorilla eyelashes.
Yes, exactly.
That's fantastic. Are you ever using your iPhone, your smartphone when you're in there?
All the time. All the time. Video. The iPhones offer so much, or the phone photography is so spectacular at the moment. It gives you the ability to video, and the video quality on them is spectacular for those close-up situations. Or if I need to jump to a wide angle, I can quickly drop in there, and I'm often taking photos of guests with the animals, with the phones, so that I can share those memories with them too. Because very often as a photographer, we're caught in a position where we are taking the photographs and we have none of ourselves doing what being there. Mm-hmm. So I love capturing people and the situation so that they too have these memories to take back with them and just enjoy the situation.
So I want to zoom out here, I guess, pun intended there, or we'll go to the 30,000 foot level here and talk. I want to talk a little bit about your photo style. The more I see other photographers, the more I'm seeing distinct styles, very specific characteristics. We have some folks that do a lot of editing. We have some folks that are going more for a purist or very in the moment, minimal editing style. This question isn't so much about editing as it is your overall style. When you create a photo, everything from setting the photo up to dialing the settings to getting it to the final version, what is the Rich DeGavea photo style and why? What's behind all that?
You know, since the moment I picked up a camera and started studying what it is to be a photographer, and this question of what's your style? How do you get to that style? I have always been very much a documentary style photographer, but I've dabbled in so many different areas. I've done portrait photography. I've done architectural photography. I've done macro photography. And the use of all of these different skills starts to hone and change the way you perceive a photo or perceive how you're going to portray it. And I'm a big fan of making photographs. So style is not key for me. I completely understand what you're saying. And there's so many photographers that I can go, oh, that's his style. I can see the photo. I don't need to look at the name. I know who the photographer is. For me, it is about telling stories. We as guides on top of photographers, as we were talking about, biologists and expedition leaders first, with our photography following in the footsteps of everything. For me, for people to understand the plight of the animals, the incredible understanding of behavior and how that's put out, I want to show people that. I want somebody to look at a photograph and feel what it felt like to have a lion right there, to see a gorilla yawn right next to you, to be part of that situation. Because there's so many people that will never get to see them in person. The closest they will get to see them is either in a zoo or in a photograph. And without educating those people, what is the point? How are we going to save those animals if those people who never see them don't love them? So I would like to connect people to those beautiful places that I'm so privileged to get to, and let them experience them too through a cell phone or through a computer screen or a video. And that is a big part of it. I think video too has become a huge part of my way forward, and I've been influenced very heavily to push towards it, because there's so many stories that can be told with video that can't be told by camera, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you brought up the idea of conservation, the weaving of the two together, and that's something I view personally as very, very important in my work. I know you do as well. I want to come back to that. But you hit on something that I think you might help shed some light on, which is the storytelling aspect. I think most photographers, especially those that have been doing it for a while, or view themselves as a bit more serious, or go on at least a trip or a couple trips a year, they know storytelling is a part of it. But I, for one, think it's probably the most abstract thing to teach in a classroom setting or in various ways. But I wonder if you could help kind of walk us through your mindset. Like, you might even think of a recent situation where you rolled up on an animal in Saudi Sand or elsewhere. And talk to me a bit about what's going through your mind in more or less setting up for the shot, specifically with a storytelling element. You alluded to it a little bit with, you know, behaviors and, of course, the environment. I think your wise words on photographing wildlife in landscapes versus strictly portraiture, I think it taps on that as well. But I'd love to hear your thoughts, your methodology, almost your workflow. You roll up on an animal on an African safari and you're thinking storytelling. What's going through your mind? And feel free to fabricate a wildlife encounter situation as you wish. But specifically with, you know, how can people start basically doing the same, rolling up on an animal, whether it's on an African safari, whether it's elsewhere in the world, and how do they begin that moment with storytelling front of mind?
That's such a great question. And I think, as you had pointed out, it's such a elusive thing to try and put in your brain and put forward. I think the more times you've been in a situation or done something, the clearer your objective becomes in the story. And I don't even have to fabricate much of a story, because I actually had one on our last trek in Rwanda in December. We'd walked in, one of the gorilla families had actually left the forest and they were feeding on eucalyptus outside of the forest. And this is clear human-animal conflict. It's clear that the space in the forest is not enough and they're coming out to get something else. And the drive of conservation is to create enough space for them so that they can breed successfully, so we have less interaction with people and ensure that people's livelihoods aren't influenced by the wildlife, so we minimize that contact. And we walked into the situation, the whole family was walking around, and I could see the volcanoes of Volcanoes National Park in the background. And I thought to myself, the photo I want here is to show, one, the gorilla with the volcano, because it's showing habitat, it's showing space. It's the greatest opportunity I'm going to have, because they were on a hillside, on the edge of a hillside. And I wanted that in the background, and the volcano was a little covered. And as an added bonus, there was a forest expansion portion that had been bought out by WWF right behind where the gorillas were. And it's just like, here's the story. This is the full story. They're out of the forest. There's the expansion. You can see the rows of bamboo that had been planted and the volcanoes in the background. And so that was the photo I was setting out to try and capture. One, hopefully a silverback, because he has the prowess, the strength, the leadership, the wow factor that comes along with it. It's like shooting a male lion versus a lioness. A lioness is really beautiful, but you throw the mane in there and it suddenly becomes something more. And eventually I went off. The guests were very comfortable where they were. I made sure everything was set. And the guides, because I've been there so much, let me roam a little bit more. And I followed the second silverback. He went down a little bit and he sat down and he was overlooking the WWF field with the volcano in the background. And the angels were singing above me and I didn't know what to do with myself. But I got really low to make him look big. He sat down. I put him on the right-hand side looking in towards the photo. So the composition becomes a huge part of that storytelling. And then the aspects flowing through, because I'm shooting with a wide angle, I've got a little bit more depth of field, which gives us a little bit more to the photo and being able to flow through it. It was this really, really powerful image that came out of it. And I was really excited by that because it's telling a story that I wish to impart on people. And when we are looking at people who don't get to do this very often, having a guide like yourself or myself go in there and be able to plant seeds of ideas is a great way to do that. To start that thought process, saying, think about when they do this, what is the story that's going to come with? The other way I like to do it is if I'm going to a new place, is I research photos from that place. I want to see what the place looks like. So I can already start forming those stories in my brain. And I might take 10,000 photographs on a trip, but I'll narrow it down to the ones that tell me stories that will give me 200 images of that. And I'm not taking 10,000 different images. I'd rather take 1,000 photographs of that one gorilla looking out in different ways so that at the end I can say, oh, there wasn't enough depth of field there, so I added a little bit more here, or I took some away there, or I went a bit wider so that I can ensure that when I get back to my editing process, that I can recreate what my eye saw. And that's what I want out of the Lightroom experiences, to recreate what my eye saw. Sometimes we tweak a little bit past to get a little bit more creative, but for the most part, for me, it's the recreation. Our eyes are the best cameras in the world. Our memories need to be held within that camera. And that's what I'm doing with a camera.
Amazing. You have just inspired me and opened my mind to, at least for me, kind of a new way of thinking about incorporating the storytelling, which is that's very definitive, but you will benefit from going into a trip, a photo session, with an understanding of what the stories are first, right? So rather than just walking up to a place or rolling up into wildlife and saying, well, what can I make of all this that tells a story? You're going another level. And obviously you understand the world wildlife and relationship. You understand the human wildlife conflict. You understand a lot of the stuff, which is, you know, very, very innate to who you are. But for other people out there, those in the audience, what a cool lesson. So powerful to think about going into a trip, going into a day photographing in, gosh, your own literal or metaphorical backyard and researching the stories that exist there to then tell them through your artistic vision. That is awesome. Awesome advice. I really love that. So fantastic. Thank you. So thank you so much for sharing that. So I want to come back to the idea of conservation. I'm a conservation photographer. You're a conservation photographer. We have a lot of folks in the audience that I think would love to and be very empowered by using their photography for conservation. Could you tell me a little bit about how you're currently doing that? And also maybe some advice to folks that want to know how to either start their own novel quests on that, or maybe advice that things that you're not doing, but other people could consider. How do you weave and how should others weave conservation and photography together?
I think first off, anyone going on a trip like this and going to take photographs is already actively partaking in the conservation effort, mm-hmm. because of the fact that we're giving money to local communities. Yes, it's a capitalist system, but we need to be able to feed money into a situation like that to make it viable. If something doesn't have an economic value, it's going to fall apart. So mm-hmm. just by being there, you're already having an effect on conservation. You're growing that point and making the wild world a better place. So that's the first part. Mm-hmm. Second part is figuring out how you wish to do it. And this is always the question that I ask somebody when they say, okay, cool, what camera should I buy? Well, what is the purpose of your photograph? Are you taking the photograph to gain memories for yourself, in which case your cell phone is going to be a great thing? Are you looking to print a few photographs and put them up on a wall? I've recently dived into the digital photo frame world, and it blows my mind because suddenly I have 5,000 family photos that I haven't looked at in years and years and years, which are rotating on a little screen, and my kids are absorbed in that. So my next step is, okay, cool. I want to get one of those nice big TVs like the Frame that Samsung makes, mm-hmm. and then have my best images go through that. Then I don't have to have one print. I can have 100 prints that rotate every 6 hours. So that's the next level. I'm getting my enjoyment out of my images, and other people that come within that proximity also get it. Or we start pushing it out to social media, which a lot of people are on. And we get lost in this world of how we become relevant in that world. It's an irrelevant place that people are trying to get hundreds and thousands and millions of likes and followers and everything. That does not change your social standing. It really is about the people you impact within that crowd of people that see your images and take in what you're saying. And it's not just about the art of photography. It's about the story you tell with it. What have you learned when you're photographing that thing? A lot of my push at the moment is doing conservation activities and trying to get people to be hands-on in conservation so that they get to experience that. They know that the dollars that they've spent, they're physically imparting that awesomeness onto this animal. You're helping it in a physical way and at the same time getting cool different images. Or thirdly, and this is my latest attempt, is now to create a book, a self-published book, which for-profit or not-for-profit doesn't make a difference. It's a challenge for myself to share these images in print, because seeing it on a screen and seeing it on a piece of paper, and I'm looking in the background of what you got behind you, I know the spaces, I've seen all of those things with the Madagascar stuff, but seeing it on a canvas or on a piece of paper changes the view of that photo. And we've become so digital that we just get stuck behind a screen and it doesn't give the same feeling as paging through a book. So mm-hmm. that's almost the next step to it. And then if you really want to throw it out there, you find worthy causes that will then give you the ability to maybe auction off a photograph for a specific conservation event that you wish to contribute towards. And that's where you're now taking extra money on top of all the other things you've done in order to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And it all is within your sphere of influence. You have to find your sphere and where you are at and how you do that. Your photos may just be shown to your friends, and that's enough for them to go on a trip to experience it. And you've already added to conservation by the fact that they are going on that same trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a great, I guess, combination of quotes that I often say, that you cannot save what you do not love and you cannot love what you do not know. So I think photographers, especially folks that are trying to get into conservation photographer or photography, they think a little bit beyond the obvious. They try to think, like, you know, what you're talking about, like the auctions, the donations of photos and all that. And those are fantastic. And they're absolutely the next level. But sometimes people don't give enough credit to the idea that your photographs get other people to know things and then to love things, to then save things. So I think that that's one of the more obvious yet more powerful ways photographs can impact conservation across the world. I want to move on to a couple other things, a little bit different topics here. You have achieved something quite unique, I think, in the photographic world, which is your relationship with Sony. You are an ambassador. You mentioned that earlier. And I think that a lot of photographers out there in the audience would, of course, benefit from and would love to know, you know, how can they link up with camera gear companies? Obviously, the number of companies that manufacture and fabricate actual cameras is finite, and those are more competitive, but there are a lot of other groups out there. Do you have any advice for people of how to get linked up with them? You know, is it as simple as putting together a portfolio and putting a little pitch deck in line, or is it more luck and right time, right place? What has your experience been, and what would you advise others to do?
So I would first off go that there's a bit of luck and a bit of work involved in everything. Knowing the right people and the right person to chat to, and being able to put your foot in the door and get that work in front of people is lucky. My flow was very lucky in the fact that the people I knew put me forward and assisted me in getting to that point. So I was first an Nikon ambassador because of my relationship with my lodge that I worked with for many years, and they put me forward. Then I did a photo talk for them, and they were like, okay, cool, let's get this guy on board. And then I changed to Sony, and the people who were bringing in the Nikon were bringing in Sony, and then they helped me swap over. And I just kept relationships. So it was all about relationships. What people don't understand is that very often we all want this cool stuff that comes with it, but they also want something in return. There's a little bit of feedback. I had to give a certain number of images across to Sony. I had to give appearances to them. I have to give workshops. I have to bring things to the table to bolster the brand. And yes, you get paid for it, or you get paid in kind for it, but it's not always as glamorous as what people perceive it to be. It's a great ego boost. Cool, to pat yourself on the back. That's great. Sony wants to see my stuff. I'm very lucky that I had it. Since I've moved to Portugal, I had to give up my ambassadorship because I couldn't fulfill my duties in South Africa. And again, it's that I'm aligned to the brand because I really believed in what they were producing. And when I jumped on board with Sony, I wanted to get in on the bottom rung and was just very lucky to get through that stage and become an ambassador and get to experience things. And for one, it got me through COVID because guiding stopped. So that was my sole form of income, mm-hmm. was trying to be creative for that. But it's not always the be all and end all. It is an ego boost. And people are searching for these things to say, ooh, Peak Design gave me this for free because I have a following of this. It's nice to get stuff for free, but they expect something in return. So figure out how you can offer them something that will bolster their brand, and they'll be far more amenable to you assisting them. A portfolio of images does one thing, but starting to create content and going, okay, cool, I am got DJI mic, these are the things I use, blah, blah, blah. Court, you've got an epic podcast that we're sitting chatting on now. If at the end you say this was shot on XYZ, people start noticing that and the brands start coming to you. everyone's trying to bang down the doors of the brands to get something for free. It's the people that are actually doing stuff that the brands come looking for you, not the other way around. So how can you add value without expecting anything in return?
That is so good. I had no idea what you were going to say, but that is just a brilliant, brilliant point. One that is kind of obvious in some ways, but also very novel and very eye-opening in others. So fantastic. On a similar front, I'd be remiss if I didn't chat about your social media following and your social media presence. I think it's something that's just absolutely fantastic to your personal mission of showcasing the wild world and getting folks to know things, to love things via a very, very popular platform. I wonder if you could share a little bit of thoughts and maybe words of wisdom there for young or new photographers out there that wish to use social media, the Instagram, the YouTube, others to, grow their following, but also to do so in the right way, to do so with a greater purpose in mind of getting people to, again, know and love this natural world, to save what we have and protect it for a long time. You alluded to a little bit earlier, something that I've always read and also believed about, you know, it's about how you impact those individual people in the crowd. Of course, you have, more or less hordes coming through to see your photos, and some of them like them, but then it's that very filtered out, distilled amount of people where you have a really big impact. Those might be the people to focus on, but I also don't want to put words in your mouth. What is your approach to social? Maybe a few words on how you got to be where you're at and what your thoughts are.
So again, social media is an interesting, it is a platform. It is a tool that a photographer or a videographer gets to use to put things out into the world. And in my opinion, it is about the value that you add to the viewer's life that makes the difference. I've had a few videos that went uber viral. We're talking 100 million views viral. That naturally throws likes and follows and everything on it. But that number is very arbitrary because it's fickle. People are following you for the next crazy thing, the next time a gorilla beats his chest or a lion runs and jumps on something. That's not what we're looking for. It's about the photos and the videos that people get to read the content, those that actually sit with your content and go through it. And how do you add value to that? And my value proposition as my time's gone on has been, oh, let's try go viral. Let's go put stuff up. And then as you go through that, and it doesn't add the value that you expect it to. So the thought process has changed to how can I give people more value and interact better with the people that I do want to interact with, not the people that are going, oh my goodness, get out of there. You shouldn't be in that space, because they have absolutely no idea or are even willing to embrace the thought of what was going on in the video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is excellent. I love that. Well, Rich, thank you so much. I want to, so obviously fantastic advice, so many gems in this talk today. People no doubt are falling in love with you as well, and they want to know where to find you. Where can we direct people to get more of Rich DeGuevea out in the world?
So I have on my Instagram handle is richard.degavere. Same on TikTok. We're on YouTube under my company, Arc Earth, where we're just trying to create more conservation-driven safaris. And we're just out there. I have a photographic website to buy prints. But again, it's not what it's about. It's really, I want to meet cool people who want to learn. And if you've got questions about this stuff, I'm happy to entertain them and help people grow, because I love seeing people love wildlife and love photography and grow with it as they're going along.
Rich, you're so generous with your time and humble. I am humbled by you. Thank you so much for joining us today. I will put all of those references, all those spots in the show notes so you can be but a click away from more time with Rich. Rich, once again, thank you for joining.
Thank you, Court. Thanks for having me, man. It's always a pleasure to chat, and I'm going to see you in a couple of months. I'm up your side of the world, so I'm sure I'll be bumping into you, and it'll be great to share another chat.
I hope so.
Well, that was a lot of fun, and what sage advice, am I right? If you'd like to learn more about Rich, please check out the links in the show notes where I have his websites and social media handles. I also have a few links to recommend gear we spoke of, and if you use these links to purchase gear on Amazon, you are directly helping to support this podcast, so I thank you in advance. Lastly, don't be a stranger. Keep in touch. If you'd like to email me thoughts and comments on the podcast or ideas for future episodes, please do so at, it's a long email, be ready, thewildphotographer.podcast@gmail.com. It's thewildphotographer.podcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to see more of my own photography work, please visit courtwhalen.com. That's courtwhalan.com, or on Instagram @court_Whalen. Oh, and I'm also starting to post episodes from The Wild Photographer on YouTube on my channel @CourtWhalen. You can just search for The Wild Photographer and Court Whalen on YouTube or any of my podcast titles as I steadily start to upload them. Thanks for checking those out and all of your support thus far. It's a pleasure, and until next time.